The How Is This Movie podcast is supported by listeners just like you. Go to patreon.com/howisthismovie. There you can pledge as little as a dollar a month and help us maintain the goal of keeping this show fully independent and free of advertising. You will also gain instant access to bonus episodes not available anywhere else. Once again, that's patreon.com/howisthismovie. And now for our featured presentation.
If you'll come with me, you'll float too.
Georgie.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to How Is This Movie? My name is Dana Buckler.
And I'm Rayanna Morrow. Thank you for taking just a little time out of your day to listen.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at How Is This Movie. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/howisthismovie. You can always email us with questions or comments at hitmpodcast@gmail.com. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment and leave a review on whatever platform you use to listen. Okay, so Ray, welcome back to How Is This Movie?
How are you, Dana?
I'm good. Now, for those that are keeping score or keeping track, you might notice that this episode is exactly 1 week late.
I know.
Than what it's supposed to be. But we have a legitimate reason why. Because we both survived the hurricane that was Irma.
Hurricane Irma. Yes, it blasted us. We're both here. Roofs still on our homes. Did you do all right, Dana?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I made the decision. I wasn't comfortable where I lived. Particular home that I live in, I didn't feel that it was probably structurally sound. It was built in the 1980s, so this was pre-Hurricane Andrew. And for those who don't know, Hurricane Andrew was this storm that just devastated Florida, and I think it was 1992. After that, you know, the rules changed on how properties were supposed to be built. They had to be able to withstand hurricane force winds. So having said all of that, I made the decision to come here, where we're at right now, my podcast recording studio, which is located in a 100-year-old brick building in the downtown Ocala area. I felt very comfortable that I was going to be secure in this location. Where did you decide to shack up at?
So my house was built post-Hurricane Andrew, so I felt pretty okay that it would be fine. I mean, I do have a lot of windows and a second story, and my mom was concerned that maybe my roof would fly off, but all in all, my house didn't suffer any damage. There were some trees down around me, but, you know.
I mean, let's be clear, though. A good portion of the area we live in really got hit hard. I mean, there are people we know. We're now 7 days from the storm, and there are still good friends of mine that still don't have power. I mean, thankfully, where I stayed at, it never lost power here. Of course, I had my own little situation happen here, which I'll be happy to share with everybody. About 3:30 in the afternoon last Sunday, it really started to rain here, and it never let up on raining. And in the actual room where I record the podcast, I noticed a small drip coming from the ceiling. Oh, there's a little bit of a leak in the roof. So I grabbed a little pan and I put it under there, and it started collecting the water very neatly. And I said, okay, well, you know, dodged a bullet on that one. Now, at 2 in the morning, I had finally fallen asleep, and I want to, you know, point out that I hadn't lost power yet. And by the way, if there's anything I learned from this hurricane preparation, is that the next time one of these storms come through, I'm not going to ride the storm out alone.
Because it's solemn.
It was really eerie to be by myself. Now, thankfully, with the advent of technology, I was able to communicate with a few people, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But about 2 in the morning, I was laying on the couch that's here in the office, and I had one of those dreams where I was outside in the rain, and I said, oh, that's really weird. And I woke up, and I said, damn, it sounds like it's raining here inside this building. And I kind of collected my thoughts, and I walked down the hallway. And this is an old office building, so there's several different rooms. And the room where the studio is at, I walked into the room, and that little drip had turned into a huge, I don't know how best to describe it. I mean, you mentioned that it was like one of those giant shower heads.
Yeah, one of the rain showers.
The rain was just pouring in. I mean, not a little drip here and there. I mean, just streams of it pouring in.
Yeah, you couldn't catch it all.
And, you know, when you're half awake and you're groggy and you're like, what is going on? I didn't know what to do. And so there's a bathroom in here that has a shower. So I just ripped the shower curtain right off the shower rod. And I just started spreading the shower curtain all over the floor, trying in vain to prevent the water from getting on the carpet. I mean, this place got fucked up. And I'm just going to tell you that, you know, as I'm trying to contain the water, I look over and there's my laptops and my mixer and my microphones and my green screen, which is soaked. And I just start doing the best I can to take everything and just put it into another room. And, you know, thankfully, the place is okay now. All my equipment was, you know, salvageable.
And you've got a shop vac, so you've been cleaning it up.
I've spent several days cleaning this place up. So that's why we were a little late getting this episode made.
Yeah, sometimes natural disasters get in the way of your best made plans. So, you know, forgive us for getting around to it a week late. I couldn't actually go see the movie because the movie theater was shut down due to Hurricane Irma opening weekend. So, you know.
Yeah, and we'll touch on how much money that movie made, and it makes me sort of begs the question how much more money the movie could have made had everyone in Florida been able to go see it. Because lest we forget, this hurricane went straight up the middle of Florida. It didn't do a cross. It went straight up the middle. So there wasn't a part of Florida that didn't, you know, suffer some type of damage. But I do want to say, just for a moment, that there were several people leading up to and including during the storm that reached out to me to see if I was doing okay. And I just want to take a moment and say thank you to Annalise, who's the host of the Dark Angels and Pretty Freaks podcast. She was checking on me, you know, almost every 4 or 5 hours. Are you okay? Do you need anything? Are you okay? Same could be said for my friend Emin in Ireland. You know, he was checking on me all the time. I had quite the long conversation back and forth with Scott Mumford, who was genuinely concerned for my well-being. And I really appreciate that, Scott. My friend Joe Warner, all the way in Australia, reached out to me just to see how things were going. So I really appreciate that, Joe. And I especially need to thank Margot Donahue, the same Margot Donahue, Margot D from Book Versus Movie. She was texting me almost every hour, you know, just to make sure I was okay. And honestly, keeping me company, which was, I go back to what I'm saying about, you know, it being very solitude here, being by myself. I really want to take the time and say thank you so much. It meant the world to me that you were concerned about my well-being. And it was very comforting to know that there were people out there that were pulling for us to get through this storm. And one more thing I want to just touch on before we start talking about the topic on hand is I ran into a bit of a serious situation with this podcast and needed some help from the podcasting hosting service that provides, you know, the storage and the bandwidth for this particular podcast. And I was in a situation I wasn't really sure how to get out of. And so I contacted the company, which is known as Podomatic. I contacted them directly for some help and assistance. And I have to tell you, they got right back to me, solved the problem in a way that I didn't even foresee that it was solvable. And I just want to say thank you so much to Podomatic. And I, you know, I don't do advertising on the show. This is not an advertisement. I haven't been paid to say this. I just really want to thank them. So I'll say this just one time. If anybody is thinking about starting a podcast and they need a podcast hosting service, I've been with Podomatic since this show's inception a little over 4 years ago, and I can't recommend them enough.
You know, customer service goes a long way. So you become loyal to great customer service, and that's, I think, what Podomatic provided for you.
Yeah, so they went above and beyond. So I really want to thank, especially Matt from Podomatic. Thank you so much, Matt. He was the one who I was talking to back and forth. A lot of emails were exchanged. I was in a bit of crisis mode, and they solved the problem. And the way they solved the problem, they didn't have to do it that way. And it was really beneficial to this show.
Awesome. All right. Well, shall we talk about the new It?
We spent some time on the last episode sort of going over the history of the movie, the history of the book, you know, the history of the miniseries. You know, I think we walked away from that episode sort of in agreement that it wasn't a very good miniseries. Like and a lot of people reached out to us. A lot of people agreed. My friend in Australia, Kevin, he said some really nice things about our last episode. Although a lot of people did write and tweet and put things on Facebook that they adamantly disagreed with our assessment on the miniseries.
You can't make everyone happy, so, you know. But movie going is a very personal experience, you know. But I did come away from our last episode really excited about the new It that was coming out. I mean, genuinely excited about how they were going to refresh the icons in it. And
yeah, I'll go ahead and say that I wasn't deterred from seeing the movie. Like that, having watched that miniseries 2 weeks ago, I wasn't like, oh, God, now we have to watch another version of this story. So I was actually really on board with it. So let's talk about first. We did not see this movie together.
No.
Dana
ditched me.
Well, our working schedules are very different. And so I had an opportunity this past week to see it. And I would like to point out, Longtime listeners of the show are really going to appreciate this. I was the only person in my movie theater.
So no debacle.
No debacle. No.
That's the best way for Dana to see a movie.
I walked into the theater 15 minutes before the film was to start. I sat down at my usual twosie seat, I-17, auditorium 15 of the local Regal Cinema. I'm sure they were just going to start flooding in, but no one came in. So I literally saw this movie by myself. Now, I saw this movie in IMAX, which had fantastic sound, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. Maybe would not see a movie like this again by myself.
In a theater all by yourself.
Where did you see the movie? How was your experience seeing the film?
I went to the matinee on a Sunday. The Buccaneers is, our area's team. So the theater was nearly empty for me as well. It was the first showing. There really weren't a lot of people in the theater. I don't know if they're still all recovering from Hurricane Irma or whatever. And it wasn't the biggest auditorium. It was, one of the mid-sized ones. So
can I ask, I always like to ask everybody who sees a movie, any bad experiences inside the theater as far as other patrons?
Not this time.
All right. Yeah. Well, you're the lucky one.
I am. I've never had as ridiculous of experiences as you. You are the lucky one.
Well, listen, if by lucky you mean I get several free admission passes to go back,
I never get a free admission pass. My movies always cost me full price.
They see me coming. They get them ready. So, all right, so we both saw the movie.
Yes.
Separate times. Mm-hmm. I saw it first and did not even tell you that I saw it because I didn't want, I didn't text you and say, I just saw the movie. You need to go see it. Hurry up. I literally just texted you on Saturday and said, so listen, just make sure you see the movie but before we record. I didn't even want to let on that I had seen the movie. I didn't want to spoil anything. So we both saw the movie. We're going to talk a lot about, the different aspects of the film, from the plot to the characters to even the setting and everything. But I guess the first question I have for you, Ray, is how was It 2017? What's your first impressions of the film?
I mean, initially, I am impressed with the movie. Production level, the acting, the sound design, the way it embodies the clown when he's not talking, really loved. I love the new makeup on Pennywise.
Yeah, I'll second that in the fact that this film certainly had a much higher production value.
It felt big budget.
It did, and it was a $35 million film, which, by the way, for a horror movie, that is big budget.
It's extensive, absolutely.
That is really a big budget. I absolutely fell in love with the kids. I thought every one of the performances by those young actors was spot on. I think the characters of Eddie and Richie were the standouts for me. Although I can understand why most people are praising Beverly's, the girl who played Beverly, her performance as being the standout. But, I thought they all did a fantastic job.
Yeah, I totally agree. The kid actors were fantastic. I mean, just really talented kids, really talented.
I also want to talk a little bit about the setting for this film. And I don't mean the location, Derry, Maine. I mean the fact that this film was set in 1989. Now, this movie tugs at my heart in a really strong way because the age of the kids in 1989 was my age in 1989. And that is putting the supernatural element out of the equation. I had a group of about five or six friends. One of them was a girl. Her name was Monica. There was one in the group. And every day in the summer, we would take our bikes and we would go on adventures. And most of those adventures involved going to the woods, building things, building a fort, whatever it is. We never spent any time inside. And every one of my friends, we all, looking back, we all had very different personalities. I found the setting particularly authentic for me, because that was exactly sort of what, again, putting the supernatural side of things aside, that was kind of what my days were like in the summertime.
Absolutely. I mean, summertime was, you know, you grabbed your bike, you grabbed a friend, and you left the house and you didn't come back until dinner. And you went on whatever adventure was in front of you. And you got as far away from the house as your bike and your legs could take you. And when you saw a reason to jump off, you just threw your bike down and ran after it. You know, I mean, that was what summer break was all about.
And that was one thing I found particularly authentic, is whenever they would get to a certain destination with their bikes, they just lay the bike, sometimes right there on the street.
They wouldn't look for a bike rack and lock it up like that, we have to do these days,
that was,
you know?
That was really authentic. And I also want to say, and I'm just going to put this out there for better or for worse, I had a New Kids on the Block cassette.
Oh, Dana, I can't believe you put that. It's going to live forever. It's going to be online.
Yeah, no.
Everybody's going to know.
You know, I have two sisters that are, you know, 2 and 4 years older than me, respectively. And so a lot of my musical influences had to have come from them. And there was some little details here and there. You know, I saw a poster for Beetlejuice. I saw the marquees on the theater said Batman, referring to Batman 89. I think it said Ghostbusters 2 on there. I saw a reference to Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, The Dream Master, the worst of the series. I'm just putting that out there. I found the setting to be authentic 1989 without it being in your face that, hey, look, we're still in the 80s. Kind of like some other things as of lately have been doing to really throw it in your face that, hey, we're in the 1980s. I found this setting to be a far more authentic setting. So from this point on, let there be a big spoiler warning attached to the rest of this episode. If you haven't seen It and you live in Florida, you get a pass. But for the rest of you, if you haven't seen It and you're listening to this conversation, just stop. Stop right now. Hit pause. Make a little notation of, you know, how far into the episode you are and just come back to it. In the last episode, we made it very abundantly clear to everyone that we hadn't read the book. Now, I'm still in the process of, you know, sort of getting through that audiobook. It's long. I mean, it's like 25 hours long. It's taking a long time. But we had pointed out that for a number of reasons, there were some vast differences between the book and the miniseries. Some of these reasons were because the miniseries was made for television, and there's a lot of stuff you couldn't put in there. The other stuff was cut for time, you know, a lot of exposition that had to be cut out of the miniseries. I think we had both discussed what our anticipations were for this new film in regards to, would any of the things that we discussed make it into this version? Any of the stuff that didn't make it into the miniseries, would it make it into this theatrical release? So, of course, we're going to start with the opening scene, the death of Georgie. You had mentioned in the previous episode that you hoped that his arm would come off.
I'm a sicko.
Well, you got your wish.
I did.
You got your wish. But there's a question I have about that, because in the audiobook, I know some people are like, just read the book.
Nah, you don't have time for that.
In the audiobook, which I've been listening to.
On your long commute to work.
On my long commute to work. The 4 minutes I spend in my car.
Exactly.
It's never alluded to that Pennywise bites the arm off of Georgie.
It's more like he yanks it off.
Yeah, I feel like even in the miniseries, it seems to me that it's implied that he bites the arm off. And so I guess that's the first thing that kind of caught my eye, a difference between the book, the miniseries, and the new film.
You know, I guess they really wanted to show those teeth. Maybe that's the deal.
You see those teeth a lot.
A lot in this movie.
A whole lot.
The whole face opens up.
Yeah.
That was pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. We're going to get to that because that's might fall into one of my issues with the film.
Stop it. You have no issues. All right. What else were you?
Well, we're just talking about some differences between the miniseries and the book and the new one. And a couple other things that we talked about that did happen in this 2017 version. I mentioned that in the book, when Henry Bowers first confronts Ben, in the book, he starts carving Henry into his stomach. And in the miniseries, that doesn't happen. Of course, in this new one, it does happen.
I was glad to see that, too.
So another one, the leper. That was a crucial scene in the book. You know, that was one of the things that Eddie was just terrified of. And this leper in the movie was, well, it was very terrifying.
That really goes back to sort of Eddie's fear of being sick instilled by his mother. So I was really glad that that made it into the movie. They really didn't do what the book does with the leper, but...
And what you mean by that is there's a constant undercurrent of the fact that what Eddie's the most afraid of is the fact that he's gay. And that's his biggest fear. And so in the book, you know, the leper is constantly propositioning him, you know. So on top, it's twofold. He's, you know, this terribly contagious, sick leper man who's offering him a blowjob at the same time.
That's deep fear stuff right there.
Now, there was one other thing that happened in the movie, one other nod to the book that was there but never ultimately had the payoff, and that was the Paul Bunyan statue.
I know. Yeah. Did not come alive, but it was there.
It was there. So there was a nod to the book, but I saw that and I said, oh, I got a little excited. Oh,
we're going to get chased by a statue.
We're going to see a Paul Bunyan statue come to life. Nah, that didn't happen. Let's talk a little bit about each of the characters, each of their moments.
You know, I got to say that one thing the movie did do, which I had hoped for and expressed on our last podcast, was that I hoped that it would take a more shapeshifter role. I really wanted to see each character have their own unique experience with their ultimate fear. And the movie did that. It did a good job of that. Every new experience that I saw a character have with it, I went, yes, good job. Not like the others. Not just the clown, you know? So
you're right. Although, yes, you're right of that. Although, to the film's detriment, I feel like the clown always makes an appearance at the end of each one of those sequences. For the most part, Eddie's being chased by the leper at the very end. Then you see this thing, clown holding balloons, and the face comes up. It's Pennywise. The scene when Mike is at outside the back of the butcher shop and there's a fire happening. You see the hands trying to escape. When that door finally ultimately opens, you see Pennywise in the background. And so I agree with you that it was nice and unique to see that it was taking on these shape-shifting forms, but at the same time, he always had to let us know, hey, it's really me doing this. And that took me out of it a little bit.
Okay.
So
it begs a question. Maybe we'll have to ask Margot, you know, how does the book take care of that? Does the clown ultimately show up at the end of each child's ultimate fear experience? I would be interested to know that.
And I'm going to reach out to Margot and find out about that. But talking about sort of each one of those kids' experiences, I'm trying to think of which one got me the most. Now, the scene when Ben is in the library, he's doing the research and the librarian comes up to him and says, this is summertime. You should be out with your friends, and, you know, kind of chastises them a little bit for being in the library, even though we're supposed to always encourage reading and learning. The library's given him the business.
Librarian's like, go out and play, you pale little fat boy. No, sorry.
So, you know, he's flipping through this book that's the history of Derry. And that was one of the very first things I said to you when you told me you saw the movie. I called you and I said, what about that scene in the library where Ben is flipping through the book? I said, if you look in the background, for no apparent reason, there's a lady, sort of an old lady, that just turns around and just holds this really menacing stance and is just staring at him. And she's out of focus, but you know she's there. It sort of cuts back between the book he's reading and a shot of him. You can see her in the background. She gets a little closer each time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was the only one in the movie theater, so I was wondering, is anybody else picking up on this? Because that part terrified me. More so than when he starts following, you know, the little Easter eggs into the bowels of the library. I found that to be one of the most frightening parts of the film.
You know, and I think that that's good horror storytelling right there, is when it's subtle. When the shapeshifter appears in the background in a sort of nondescript role and then becomes the red balloon that floats towards the stairs where the Easter eggs begin appearing that Ben ultimately follows down into the basement. I thought that that was well done, as far as less in-your-face horror, more subtlety.
What I liked about that is the fact that there was no ultimate payoff with that woman that was just standing there. So you're left, when the scene is over, you're going,
well, she became the balloon.
Well, I know, but part of me was like, did I see that? Like, I'm literally, when you start to question yourself, like that, to
that's
me,
good horror.
That's good horror.
Right.
The Beverly scene, where she, I mean,
I like the Beverly scene because it's broken up into multiple mini stories. First, you know, she's harassed by her dad. She goes into the bathroom to hide with her teenage angst and fear and, you know, ultimate sadness and an abused child, basically. And she cuts off all of her hair, you know, and that's supposed to be a liberation of sorts. And then we come back to the bathroom and it's the hair that comes up from the drain and traps her above it before the blood explodes everywhere, you know. And I just love that they retained that portion of the story.
I mean, it seemed to me like she had the most going on. I mean, she had the issues at school with the kids at school bothering her,
mm-hmm.
to only to come home
and have a dad.
Have the father who's, I mean, listen, the movie makes no allusion as to what's going on in that relationship. Yeah. And then she's
still
also
my
got...
girl, Bev.
No. Yeah. She still has to deal with the entity.
Right.
I mean, that poor child had all kinds of things going on. And kudos to her for keeping it together.
Right.
A couple of the scenes that probably didn't work as well for me, the Stan scene when he's in the synagogue. I found that to be kind of one of the more weaker scenes as far as the each child gets its own
ultimate fear,
and this one I thought was kind of weak.
While we're sitting here talking about it, you know, a lot of what, you know, he's got an overbearing rabbi father and he has to live up to this sort of ancestral
tradition
requirement. Yeah, yeah. You know, like your dad's a rabbi, you have to become a rabbi, and he can't even remember his prayers or, you know, whatever he's supposed to recite. And so he's afraid of his past, you know, haunting him and these people, you know, of the, you know, his religious organization, you know, outcasting him. And that's a child fear, you know, is to not be accepted by your family or the community. And
let's talk about the parents just for a second there, because going through each one. So we know the situation that Beverly has with her father.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We know the situation that Eddie has with his mother.
Right.
Who is...
She's the germaphobe,
yeah,
really.
Yeah,
you know,
she's terrifying as well.
Does that mean, what's the condition where...
Hypochondriac?
His mom's a hypochondriac, but then she forces it on him,
right,
making him think he's sick, and he's not sick at all. There's a term for that. I can't remember.
Eddie has issues with his mom. Beverly has issues with the father. Bill doesn't really have issues with his parents, per se.
I mean, right.
I mean, there's an issue. I mean, the child was gone missing, which, again... That's vastly different from both the book and the miniseries. Georgie doesn't go missing in the source material or the miniseries.
Right. Yeah, he's found in the street.
We know that Mike, the situation with Mike is he saw his parents burned to death.
Right.
And so he's got this overbearing. Is this a stepdad? Is this an uncle? I never really got an opportunity
seems
to
like
figure
family.
Out who it was. Yeah.
Seems like family, but you're not my dad, you know, is his big yelling thing. And I don't want to shoot these damn sheep.
Yeah,
in the head.
All I kept thinking was No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Now you understand what that little device looks like in person and how it really works with a real world application.
You know, and he's, you know, overbearing. Do you want to be a sheep? You're not my dad, you know.
The kids are the most interesting part of this film. Can we just go ahead and say that I found them incredibly enjoyable? Their on-screen chemistry was fantastic. I had read that the director, Andy Muschietti, I think I got his name pronounced correctly this
Perfect.
Time. He purposely had the kids spend 3 weeks together out swimming, you know, riding bikes, just getting to know each other. So the bond that you see that they have on screen is authentic. Yeah. And at the same time, didn't introduce the kids to Bill Sarsgaard's Pennywise character until a month into shooting. And so they literally saw him first time on set in makeup. And so those reactions were real. So we love the kids. We can agree on that.
Absolutely.
We love the
Absolutely.
Setting. We find the setting to be authentic.
Absolutely.
We find where we love the fact that each kid gets its own experience with it, although some better than others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's one thing we haven't talked about yet.
What is that?
That would be Pennywise the Dancing Clown.
Oh, Pennywise the Dancing Clown. Yeah.
So, you know, we're a half an hour into this and we haven't even brought up, you know, the most iconic role
Elephant
of the film.
Elephant in the room, yeah.
Let me take you through my experience with the first opening scene. You know, there were trailers and brief little snippets of the encounter that Georgie has with Pennywise. The actual encounter on screen is a little bit longer than those little trailers that were showing it. That was probably one of the only times I really liked his persona on screen. I thought that was one of the only times I thought he was scary. So I'm just going to go ahead and say that.
I loved his makeup.
Yes.
And I thought that his outfit was fantastic. I thought whoever dressed him and designed him, his character design in the movie, was fantastic. I really missed the way Tim Curry says, "We all float down here. You'll float too." Skarsgård didn't nail that for me.
Do you remember last week when we talked about the Jack Nicholson Batman comparison and we wondered if...
He's not Heath Ledger.
Yeah, we wondered if Sarsgaard would have the Heath Ledger effect on the Joker character. And
mm-hmm.
For me, the answer to that is no. Right. I think Tim Curry did a better Pennywise than this guy. So that's going to bring me to a few of the issues I really have with this film. And the first one is going to be bad CGI.
Really? In what scenes? I mean, I know you don't like CGI, Dana, so...
I've always been a practical effects type person, and that's something that I've been championing for a very, very long time.
I know.
I think in some cases, but I've always made the, argument that CGI in supernatural films get a pass. However,
which part didn't get the pass for you?
Anytime he opened his mouth, to be honest with you, the opening scene when he goes in to bite Georgie's arm, I was like, you can't spend a few thousand dollars and get some type of real prosthetic. It didn't look real. Right. And to me that, and I don't want to sound like I'm nitpicking here, but that it's 2017.
Right.
There's no excuse for that.
What else?
Other thing that I took issue with the film, and this one took me out of it more than the bad CGI, was the formula that they used for the film, the formula that the director used for the film. And by formula, I meant, hey, what has worked in the past 5 to 10 years with these type of horror films? Jump scares. I thought that there was in an unnecessarily large amount of jump scares. You know, that all of a sudden, suddenly something just jumps out and you know something and you get all tense and because you know something's about to pop out. That's, to me, that's not psychological. When the lady turns around and stares at Ben in the library, that was terrifying to me because it was out of focus and I was wondering what is going to happen. That, there wasn't like a jump scare moment there. There was a real moment of, what the fuck is that?
Right.
That was terrifying. And I bring you back to a scene in the miniseries. Going back to the 1990 miniseries, in the second part, yes, I'm going to say something positive about the second half of the 1990 miniseries. When Beverly goes back to revisit her house and the old lady answers the door and they're sharing the, you know, they're having a cup of tea. When the lady quickly morphs into sort of that dead figure, it's supposed to be her dad, and Beverly makes a decision to jump up and leave the house. You see the old lady chase her. That scared the shit out of me. That was terrifying.
Right.
I'm like, oh my God, she's really chasing her.
Get her.
You know, there wasn't fast editing going on there. So, and I'm looking at, let's take a look here. I've got the list here in front of me. Where the jump scares were unnecessary for me would have been when Ben follows the Easter eggs into the library. Richie, when he goes into the clown room. I mean, that was, that right there, as soon as he went into the room with all the clowns, I was like, oh fuck, here we go. Here we, well, we're going to get a big scare here. I think that whole thing really bothered me to the point where it was really taking me out of the movie. I don't want the jump scares. I want to see the kids. I want to see them interacting with each other. I want to see them in... I don't want to see one kid isolated in a room surrounded by clowns because I know the ultimate payoff of that is just going to be surprise. And so that really took me out of the movie. I'll just say it.
I didn't have as much problem with the jump scares because you had mentioned Conjuring, that it reminded you of the Conjuring before we got started recording. And it is a shapeshifter. It's an energy body. It's a supernatural being. And jump scares for me make a lot of sense when you're dealing with that kind of scary creature. They don't move like a human. And so Pennywise not being bound to human-like movements somehow felt right to me. So,
you know, and I can see where you're going with that, and that's fair. I'll give you that. But for me, I'm talking about a filmmaker's decision and choice on how those jump scares are presented on screen. And particularly when you see a film in IMAX, it's the sudden music, the sudden violin string that happens. Then it's so jarring.
Isn't that what a horror movie is supposed to do, Dana?
But is it, though?
I mean,
is it? So, because don't get me wrong. One or two is fine.
Okay.
I saw Get Out earlier this year. That movie has two on purpose jump scares that were so effective that everybody in the audience laughed because the tension had been running high, but it didn't set up. You didn't know it was going to happen.
Right. It was an
authentic jump scare. Whereas in this one, you know it's going to happen. You know that when the picture falls off the wall, when Stan's having his experience and he puts it back up and the crazy looking lady in the painting's not there anymore, you know as soon as he turns around, she's going to be there. And the music lets you know. It's like, and it lets you know. So those are, to me, are kind of forced jump scares. And so that's kind of the issue I had with the film, is too much of that.
Right.
Too much. I'll even give the bad CGI a pass more so than these unnecessary jump scares.
Got it. Okay, well, that's fair.
You know, that brings me to another thing I had an issue with the film. They seemed to know an awful lot about what was going on and how to deal with it, more so than I think they would have, in reality, does that make any sense? Like, they knew to go to this house, they knew to go here, they knew to go there. Now, I know Ben did a lot of research and they had blueprints.
That's
and everything.
Another big difference. I meant to mention that earlier. You know, in the original miniseries, it's Mike. That's the librarian, and this time it's Ben. So that threw me for a loop when we first started. It's like, oh, is Ben going to be our little historian now?
And turns out he was. Right. So, I mean, he was able to kind of figure out where they need to go, I suppose, but it just seemed like Bill had all the answers, and this is what we're going to do. And, you know, Beverly gets kidnapped by Pennywise, you know, which I guess is an attempt to get them to go into his area. And listen, this is the part where I tell you that the ending really kind of fell apart for me. And so much so, and I'm just going to go ahead and say it, that I left before the movie was over.
Yeah. Dana, as soon as Dana heard I had seen the movie, he called me and said, how did it end?
I said, listen, you know, I got to the part where she's floating, you know, all the kids, they're floating. I thought that was kind of fun. You know, they're all float here. And then Pennywise is introduced and he does his little dance and things like that. And you know, he opens up his mouth and we see all those teeth, bad CGI. And Beverly sees the deadlights. And it was right after the part where Henry gets pushed down the well by Mike, and so it's implied that perhaps Henry has died, and that kind of had me head scratching a little bit because he plays an integral role in the second half of the book, I suppose, based mm-hmm. on the miniseries. But I have to tell you, I was kind of exhausted by that point in the film. Like, I had kind of, the movie was two different, it was two different things for me. Like, all the parts where the kids were not dealing with Pennywise or it, and they were just being the kids, and their interactions and their chemistry was so great and so much fun. And I'd love to see a movie just seeing their sort of coming of age story told through a summer. By the time we got into the well and they're down there and everything, I was mentally exhausted from all the jump scares. Again, I bring that up to you. I was
mentally, you know what I just realized? You didn't see one of the best scenes in the movie.
Which was?
At the very end, you know, so they decided they did not, we knew that they weren't going to include the orgy scene.
Yeah, that wasn't happening.
And they didn't. They didn't even allude to it. They actually, you would say they negative alluded to it. Like, there was an absolute absence of any indication that might have happened. And in fact, I don't recall a scene ever where they were like, we all got to stick together. Did that happen?
Yeah, I'm sure that. At some point.
So, but at the end, they all do this blood oath on the palm of their hand where they cut their hand. And I know that is a big thing in the book because when they're adults and they're getting all the calls or whatever, the scar shows up again.
Oh, okay. See, and I mean, when I say I left with like 10 minutes left in the movie. And I had a pretty good indication of how this was going to end.
Everybody survived.
Everybody survives. And I was...
Because there's a second movie.
There is definitely going to be a second movie. So let's talk about our overall thoughts on the film. So I'll begin. I went into this movie with, you know, we joked about the miniseries had set the bar very low, but I went into this film with pretty high expectations.
Yeah, the previews were so good. Trailers were awesome.
The marketing campaign for this film was phenomenal. Whoever came up with the marketing campaign for this movie deserves a good bonus and perhaps hopefully some back end on the $400 million they've already taken in so far. So I went in this film with a lot of really good anticipation and excitement. And I'm not going to walk away from this conversation saying that this was a bad movie, because it wasn't a bad movie. It was, I thought, well done, minus a few CGI. So mm-hmm. on a production level, I thought it was well done. The characters, the kids were phenomenal. Let that be a lesson to anyone who wants to make a horror movie. Have very interesting characters you care about, mm-hmm. and that will make for a better film. But I found it to be very formulaic and a very by-the-book horror film that...
By-the-book, tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I'm
yeah,
sorry. No, that's couldn't good. Help it.
But no, I found it to be very, very basic in the way that the horror itself... You're going to see an R-rated horror movie, and what we got was a very typical R-rated horror movie that had great characters. Don't get me wrong.
So isn't that a win? I'm just curious.
Yeah, no.
I mean, the reality is the bar is very low for horror films for me, right, in the theater. Like, I'm just not scared that easily. The characters are usually so blasé. And, you know, so I was just thinking about it. You know, I wouldn't see it again.
That is always the benchmark for a great movie for me.
Right.
Is, do I want to see it again? I'll give you an example. When I saw The Dark Knight, I wanted to see it again.
Still want to see it again.
When I saw The Force Awakens, I saw it the next day. When I saw Rogue One,
I'm having trouble finishing it.
But that's the thing. That's, and see, here's the thing. And I don't think Rogue One's a bad movie. No. You know, I think the third act of Rogue One is very entertaining. Takes a while to get there. But what I'm saying is, I don't think it is a bad movie. It's just not one of those. I don't think it's a great movie. And it's not one that, like, when I saw the movie, I saw it before you did. I didn't say to you, when are you going to go see it? I'm coming with you because I want to see your reactions to the film. I was just like, hey, we're going to record on Monday. Make sure you see it by then.
Right.
So that, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is that it didn't resonate with me in the sense that I'm not really excited to see it again. And I will see, I'll see it again when it's on Netflix or HBO or something like that. But I'm not going to run out and go see the movie again. Your thoughts on the film?
It's interesting for me that my perspective as I left the movie was meh. But as we discuss it, I think, God, the character development was fantastic. The set design was amazing. Aside from the couple of CGI, some of the teeth were just too much. But I liked the jump scares. I didn't have a problem with those. You know, so why am I disappointed by this movie is the question I keep asking myself. Did I think the bar was set low, but really I expected a lot out of it? Or, you know, is it because we did the podcast about it? So I just really hoped it would, you know, blow my socks off. But, you know, the reality is they did a lot of the things I really wanted them to do. Each kid had their own separate experience with it. It was a supernatural force. It wasn't just a clown with some tricks up his sleeves. Skarsgård was fine as long as he wasn't talking. I'm sorry. And, you know, I mean, so all in all, really it gave me everything I expect out of a horror film. Plus good acting. Why am I disappointed? It's a question I'm having trouble figuring out the answer to. It's, you know, I may see it when it's out on video. You know, not, I mean, who watched it? Anyway, not video, obviously.
Will you be getting that at the Blockbuster?
I will go to the Blockbuster and get that and put it in my non-existent VCR. You know, I'll see it when it's, you know, on TV with my daughter or whatever. But it's, yeah, you know. I think I wish I had just read the book, kind of, because then my mind would have created my own jump scares.
What happens is because we become so fluent in the source material and the material that it's almost like nothing's going to surprise us on screen anymore. It's like we expect these things. Oh, look, there's the Paul Bunyan. There's everything that we anticipated happening. It happened.
Right.
But it was kind of like, I imagine this movie will resonate really well with younger people that haven't seen the miniseries, haven't read the book. If they just go see the movie as is, not knowing as much as we've learned about the whole, you know, process.
That's probably why it has such good reviews.
They're probably going to have a great time with this movie. So I'm struggling like you because the movie does have a lot of really good qualities about it. But I feel like some of the qualities, some of the not so good qualities for me kind of outweigh the overall experience of the film. So I have to give it a soft recommend at best. You know, they're going to make another one of these. They're going to do it with the adults this time. You know, the trailers better blow my socks off because I don't see myself right now jumping through any hoops or taking a day off work to go see this movie opening weekend. That's it, I guess. I mean,
all in all, I've got to say, I really enjoyed learning about the book, watching the miniseries. It seems less bad now that I've seen the new movie.
Can I just say that I, and here's the thing I wasn't sure if we were going to touch on or not. I think I enjoy the first half of the miniseries, It, more than this movie, and it has a lot of the same beats, and that's something I didn't think I would say prior to seeing this new film, is I think the first half of the It miniseries is better.
And for me, that had to do with pacing. The first half of the It miniseries is such a quick pace, jumps between so many interesting characters. You've got, you know, basically 14 main characters in that they're all introducing, both young and old. And so that was more dynamic. It felt more dynamic.
And it had less jump scares. And that's a thing. I'm sorry, that's a thing. And I don't want to end on that note. But
God.
But it did have less jump scares. Anyway, so that...
I like jump scares.
Well, I'm in the other camp.
What's your favorite ride at Universal Studios?
I like the Hulk. That's a roller coaster if you've never been to Universal Studios.
I like the jump scare ones.
The jump scares.
I always go Haunted Horror Nights so that I can get a lot of jump scares.
So you're talking about the Halloween Horror Nights. Before we wrap up, all right, for those who've never those that are somewhat new to my show, listen to the episode entitled The History of Elm Street. All right. I tell a little story about when I went to Universal's Halloween Horror Nights. No, I don't do well at those. If you've never been to Halloween Horror Nights, it's a series of haunted houses with a massive production budget. And it's just a series of real-life jump scares.
And you literally walk through them screaming because everything's jumping out at you and it's awesome.
Yeah. So maybe it's just me. Okay. So on that note, I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up today. And I'm sorry that it took us so long to get this episode out.
Yeah, blame Irma.
We're going to blame Hurricane Irma.
Yeah.
So once again, for those who didn't get a chance to listen to our first episode on it, Ray is not only my friend, she's also a podcaster herself. She has a podcast called Just Be You Podcast, which I have the privilege of being the editor and co-producer on. And you'll find a link to her podcast in this episode's show notes.
So check out episode 10.
Check out episode 10. That's one of my favorite episodes that you did.
Yeah, I bet.
So, Ray, thanks for coming on.
Dana, I appreciate your time.
So for Rayana, my name is Dana Buckler. Thank you so much for listening.
The How Is This Movie podcast is produced by Dana Buckler for Hidden Productions, located in Ocala, Florida. Please follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at How Is This Movie, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/How Is This Movie. Of course, you can always email the show with questions or comments at hitmpodcast@gmail.com. And finally, to become a monthly supporter of this podcast and gain instant access to bonus episodes not available anywhere else, go to patreon.com/How Is This Movie. You'll find all the links to our social media in this episode's show notes.